You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsports.com.
What's up, Internet? My name is Matt Pollard, and you are listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsports.com, powered by Last Word on Sports Incorporated, the Beautiful Game Network, Golden Goal Press, and Roughneck Scars. My good friend Daniel Sperry, it has been one crazy week for both of us as far as sports is concerned. I am back from London after seeing Fulham play at Craven Cottage and get a very rare win. We are currently in the middle of a low-key Dan Matt Derby in the San Jose Sharks, up 2-1 over the Colorado Avalanche, and we got a boatload of stuff to talk about in MLS. Are you buzzing right now, my friend? Because I'm jacked.
Yeah, dude. This is like ultimate sports time right now, so I'm absolutely stoked. Out of the corner of my eye, I've got this game 4 of the Sharks Avs series. So, on top of it, all the fun soccer, baseball's back in full swing. My Giants beat your Dodgers in this series. There's just a lot going on, and it's like not just like in day to day life, but then with sports and stuff. And it's a busy time, but it's always like that time of the year that like, okay, I can't wait until March Madness, because right after March Madness is when everything else like really hits. That's right when MLS comes into swing. You hit playoffs for NBA and NHL, baseball starting. It is absolutely insane this time of the year, and it's probably my favorite like 3 month stretch pretty much.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we've got an extra long sports equinox in this late spring, early summer, because normally you get into, well, it's not relevant for us as, you know, two guys who like soccer and baseball, but, you know, you get into June, and then once the NBA Finals and the Stanley Cup Finals, you know, things start to slow down. But then we've got Gold Cup and the Women's World Cup. So, you know, we're good to the middle of July. And then at that point, we're only, you know, 1 month, 6 weeks away from, at least for me, college football starting up, and then obviously we'll have NFL, so it's great. But let's get to the footy, Dan, and we will start with some breaking news. Yesterday, out of Commerce City, Colorado, Anthony Hudson has officially been sacked by the Colorado Rapids. Longtime striker in MLS and for the Rapids, won an MLS Cup in 2010. Connor Casey will take over as interim manager. He came in as an interim manager in the final year of Pablo Mastroianni being the head coach of the Colorado Rapids, and then has retained the assistant position that he had under Anthony Hudson. Effectively an offensive coordinator, most of what he did with the Rapids in training was pretty exclusively working with the strikers, but he's effectively in a caretaker position. Dan, the Hudson era for the Colorado Rapids, I think, will go down as possibly one of the worst for a full-time head coach who had at least one full MLS season together. Just 8 wins over the course of 43 games played. Some pretty incendiary comments from Coach Hudson on Saturday after the loss to Atlanta United in what was ultimately his final game coaching the Pids. Lots of turnover of roster, lots of spending of money, lots of instances of Stan Kroenke being willing to put more money towards the first team than previously anticipated, and really a lot of signings, mainly foreign ones, that were completely botched, whether it was DPs and having to waive Skelshengashi, who was a lame duck with the team, many lower division English and Scottish players who cost international roster spots and target allocation money not really working out. And at this point, you know, like Porrick Smith is out of people to blame in terms of scapegoating other people. In 2017, it was all on Pablo Mastroianni. This year, it was, you know, all on Anthony Hudson, but he's overseen pretty much every single one of the signings, other than Tim Howard mainly, in terms of overtaking this team, and is largely responsible for the fact that this team is not playing up to the sum of their parts. Dan, how do you, from afar, how do you make sense of what's happening with the Colorado Rapids, and just the ultimately what led to the decision, you know, on Wednesday early morning?
Favorite retweet, a whole lot that you said on that, just about what was going on with them. I know that, you know, you've seen a lot of articles about, you know, it kind of runs deeper than Kroenke and such. And, you know, you have to kind of wonder that what the player's reaction is about this going forward. How do they respond? What does Connor Casey do to kind of change things up? Because they clearly need a change. I think though, if there's anything that really is going to stand out for me, from the era of Anthony Hudson in charge of the Colorado Rapids, it's going to be how many times he, has, a tactical lineup or a setup, based on premonition and not necessarily, a certain idea and way of playing, that the roster does not provide. I think that's the number one thing is that the one thing that Mascherini, for as as quickly as he was let go, and all of the things that they decided to let him go for, and the struggles that he had, thing that the Colorado Rapids had was an identifiable way of playing the game, whether it was great or not so great, whether it worked at times, they always consistently had a style of play. Hudson, I think, just tinkered too much with lineups. He tried to get, was it last year? I think he was doing it was like a back three and wing backs and kind of things. That did not suit the personnel on the team. That did not, the midfielders for that role that were so important did not suit that type of role. And what he's been trying to do this year has not suited the type of players that he has put in a lot of positions. So, there's a whole lot that that has kind of gone on and has been going on with you can talk about ownership. You can talk about this, but this roster is an improved roster from last year and it is still miserable. And I think at that point, you kind of look at the coach putting everything together. You look at a coach who's consistently, maybe not so much playing players out of position, but playing players in roles that their skill sets don't demand. You can play a midfielder as a central midfielder and people are like, well, he's not playing him out of position. But if you're playing a guy who is a strict number eight or and you're asking him to be a number 10, or you're asking Benny Failhaber to be your number six, you're not like, that's not a good midfield. That's not a good setup for what you're trying to do. So there's so much that has gone wrong with the Hudson thing, and that has been going on behind the scenes with the Rapids and, bot signings and stuff. I think there's a lot of it that kind of goes on Padraig Smith as well. Right now he's not usually there's a couple of coaches who get the axe before the GM or the decision maker of the coaches gets the axe. And so sooner or later, I wouldn't be shocked if Padraig Smith is the one who does get the axe, unless they get the next coaching hire right. And that coaching hire comes in. You don't have a Brad Friedel type. You don't have this Anthony Hudson guy who was renowned. He came with some high praise, but didn't have a whole lot of experience and had an international experience with New Zealand, who plays in a qualifying region that is insanely easy to qualify and play out of. It's easy when you're playing, Fiji, and Vanuatu, in these little, and Papua New Guinea in your World Cup qualifying round, then you're going to get good results. But things change when you come back to, a good club standing in a league that has, since he's been here, has kind of grown exponentially. So in terms of quality around the league and the types of players. So, I think the Rapids are better, and I think that, like I said, the number one thing that sticks out to me from this Hudson era is just there's so much of him putting players, like I said, not out of position, but demanding, roles and, ideas from players and execution from players in roles and that don't fit their strong suits and their skill sets. And it was just consistent. The idea of we're going to do this, because, I want to do this, not because the players that we have available to us kind of this way. And I need to adapt at that point, the coach, you can complain about the roster all you want. If Connor Casey doesn't win a game with the Rapid the entire rest of the season, then I think Hudson, comments are validated a little bit, but I don't think that's going to be the case. You also look at it and say, okay, I don't think he was putting a lot of players in the right positions to succeed. And I think that's going to be, I think that's what the big, as an outside observer of Colorado and the Rapids, that's kind of the biggest takeaway on Hudson, and his reign, with the,
I echo your point, Dan, about Hudson being a tinker master and then, you know, doing it in a, we'll say a 2016-2017 year, Claudio Ranieri, rather than the year prior when Leicester City won the Premier League, and probably the best sports story of our lifetime, certainly. He never really, whether it was the 3-5-2 or the 4-4-2 diamond, was just never able to get things right in the midfield, both as far as personnel and then assignments and then greater tactical shape. And at any point, there were stretches there where the midfield was able to support the defense and the team was stable from a defensive standpoint, but then they were just so lacking, you know, the forwards were on an island. And then in other situations, more so this year, it's been the exact opposite, where Benny Feldhaber, Nicolas Mesquita, Kellen Acosta, you can throw in Cole Bassett, they've been able to get in and have a good presence in the offense and support the Kai Kamaras and the Diego Rubios of the world, and then add in the fullbacks overlapping Keegan Rose and Barry, certainly, but then they do so at the complete expense of the defense. Just that midfield situation was never able to work on a whole for a long stretch where it was able to support the attack with numbers in possession and then also be the shield that guards the center backs that were just clearly, clearly lacking. And he was never able to figure that out. And, you know, with the 3-5-2, he just didn't really have the horses for it. And there was an issue of assigned positions. The really only one certainty, one consistency they've had is that, Jack Price has been the Regista number six in every single shape that they've been in this season. But, you know, I've joked in the last couple of weeks about how the 4-4-2 diamond was really more of it was a Rorschach test where it was whatever you thought it was or you ever wanted it to be. You looked at it and that's what you saw, but at times it was a 4-4-2 diamond, at times it completely flattened out, at times it was a 4-2-2-2 if I have the right number of twos that add up to 11 at that point. And you know, that there wasn't any consistency of it. You know, Benny Feldhaber's had to play all over the field. You know, Kellen Acosta hasn't really been comfortable. There's just been so much that's gone wrong with that, and that falls on Hudson. I agree with your notes about him. He and Porrick Smith together brought in players that play the style of play for what they wanted to be, but just weren't at a level to where they could do it consistently in MLS, and Hudson either did not realize or refused to accept that and try and play other ways such that they could actually get results. You know, I think about the game in Atlanta, against Atlanta last year, that would have been at DSG Park, I believe on a Sunday, and then I think it was 3-0 to Atlanta, and the Rapids had a whole bunch of possession, and they created a bunch of chances, and they tried to be this attacking, dynamic team, play possessing soccer, and in doing so, they had huge gaps between where their midfield was and where the back line was, and Joseph Martinez, Julian Gressel, and Miguel Amarone just completely ate them up, and Hudson, you know, stubbornly kept putting the lambs to the slaughter to try and play the way he wanted to play when he flat out didn't have the horses. And Hudson wants to say all he wants that the team didn't really have a whole lot of talent, but these were guys that he brought in. You know, on every single player on the roster right now who is listed as a defender, with the exception of two, came in with him being the head coach and with Porrick Smith being the full-time general manager, not the interim GM, which the position that he had at the end of 2016, and then he became the full-time GM in time for January 2018. So right as that first transfer window was opening with them. So they had Axel Schubert, who 2 years prior to Hudson coming in was a Defender of the Year candidate, lost out to Yella Van Dam because, you know, voter MLS popularity, LA Galaxy, okay. And then the year before Hudson came in, 2017, Pablo Mascherini getting fired, that was Court Ford's rookie year out of DU, and he was a Rookie of the Year candidate. And so those are probably the two best center backs that you have on this team right now. Every single other defender who's been brought in has been brought in by Anthony Hudson. And in all of my conversations that I had with him and I had with Porrick Smith, is the two were in lockstep in terms of their ideas. So you want to say that you're a bottom team with a bottom group of players, you're the one who brought these guys in. Declan Wynn and Tommy Smith were one of your guys. Now you have if they were losing all these games, but it was, you know, three teenage homegrowns starting on the back line and building of the future, you could say, okay, like I understand that, but it's consistently Tommy Smith going out there and making mistakes that single-handedly concede goals. It's the team shuffling out who plays at left back, and then that player is caught out of position such that the team gives up a goal after you lose Edgar Castillo last year and made no additions to replace him, with, I guess, with the exception of saying that Sam Vines was going to be with the first team rather than on loan to USL club. He was with Charlotte last year. I was under the impression that he was going to spend a significant amount of time in Colorado Springs this year. So he can complain all he wants, but he was part of building this team. And if he's not, then I have 2 years of comments between him and his immediate supervisor that are unilaterally contradictory from all of that. So, okay, like, you can't complain about not having the horses when you were the one who picked the horse, raised the horse, and then put the horse in that position. Like, you have to be on some level at fault for ultimately not winning the Kentucky Derby. You can't just go and blame your owner for not picking the right horse. So, I think Hudson certainly deserves a big slice of blame pie for the club being where it's at, but I think a lot of it now ultimately falls on Porrick Smith, because Smith did a worldwide search and spent 3 months looking for him and then picked Hudson and praised him. And, you know, I got the media sheet that they had when they had the announcement, and there were quotes from Jose Mourinho and Pep Guardiola and all these big coaches about what they thought of Anthony Hudson. And this was their guy, and they put him up on a mantle, and now, you know, he's chopped liver. So the Rapids have some really big decisions to make over the course of the final 8 months of this year. That are going to impact the team for the long term. They have to get this coaching hire right. And Porrick Smith has been saying basically for 2 years now, promising that once the DP slots open up, Skelton Gashi no longer with the club, you know, Tim Howard retiring at the end of the season, that they're bringing in a DP number 9 and a DP number 10. And Porrick has a very, very bad track record with big money foreign signings coming in and then being busts or not living up to their salary. He has to get all three of those decisions, the two DPs and the head coach, right. Otherwise, realistically, the Rapids aren't looking at remotely being competitive by or after 2022. And at that point, I think you got a clean house. And I don't know where the club goes at that point. All right, we've beaten this dead horse too long. Dan, let's get on to teams that are actually good and actually relevant in MLS. And we will start with the team at the top of the Eastern Conference, and that's the Philadelphia Union, who quietly have been really, really good. And we were talking about, is Jim Curtin on the hot seat with only being on 1 year on his contract, and they're playing a pressing style, and they got rid of CJ Sapong at the beginning of the year, but they've got it done with a workmanlike young defense, and that's been with Marco Fabian not being completely impactful, and Harris Madunian and Alejandro Bedoya are absolutely balling out, and whoever's been at forward has just gotten the job done. I mean, like, we owe the dupes some praise, right, Dan?
Yeah, I mean, good for them. They are still the shiniest of the turds, because the Eastern Conference has been just pretty bad so far. And it's one of those wild rides where, like, you're sitting there and you're like, man, Montreal Impact haven't had Nacho Piatti since like their third game of the season, and yet they are sitting in it's hockey. Of course, as I said, that was out of the corner of my eye, and I don't know how Martin Jones, who was the worst goalkeeper in the regular season of any starting goalkeeper, just has made the most incredible save and been really good. Anyways, like, Montreal Impact are in third place. Toronto FC, who were terrible to start the season, are all of a sudden in fourth. And then you have guys like Atlanta and New York Red Bulls sitting ninth and tenth on 8 points, which, even though the West has not been great, that still would not be, you know, they'd be sitting below the San Jose Earthquakes on points in the Western Conference. So the East is so confusing, but props to Marco Fabian has still taken a while to kind of get going as a consistent goal scorer and contributor. He hasn't been the DP that maybe many thought he would, but he's been good enough for them. And the system that they've been getting, it's a newer system. It's a new way that they're running and doing things. It's not a new coach, but just a slightly new system that Jim Curtin has embraced under Ernst Tanner. And it is starting to pay off and pay dividends. And usually when you institute a new idea like that, it takes a little while. In Kansas City, they've had another, you know, they lost at home to Toronto FC, but after that, they've looked pretty good going forward. So the Union have been really impressive. They're taking care of business at home, which is something that the Union, I don't think, did very well in the past. They do have a road win. They've got a couple of points. They got about 5 points on the road so far this season, but they're taking care of business at home, which is big. The Union haven't always done that, and I think that's a good sign for them going forward. So props to them, but they've done a good job of, this is their system, they're going to stick to it, and they've done a good job of acclimating certain players to it and finding the players within their current roster to correctly use their system. Now, do they miss CJ Sapong? You could maybe argue down the road they might. However, I'm impressed with what the Union are doing. Granted, three teams are tied at 17 points. They just have the best goal differential. But they have scored the second most goals in the East, and they have one of the better defensive records in the East as well. Outside of the Red Bulls in Atlanta, who just don't score any goals in their games, apparently, because they're not even in double digits for goals scored or goals against. So, low scoring games there, but the Union have taken care of business. They've done it on the road and at home. And it's impressive so far early in the season. So props to them. They've done a good job, and they do deserve their plaudits. And Jim Curtin definitely does deserve some plaudits. But I do like what he said. I think he said nobody remembers who's in first place in April or May, whatever month he said. But nobody remembers that. You know, they remember who was in first place at the end of the season and who lifted trophies. So at some point, if things go south, you know, Philadelphia Union fans might be the only ones to remember that they were in first place in May, and are frustrated to no end by it. So it's one of those things, if they've got to keep it up, they've got to keep going. You're going to expect an Atlanta United and a New York Red Bulls to come charging up the standings here in the next couple of weeks, maybe in a couple of months here. So, you know, they still have to do the work and get the job done that's been set out in front of them, but props to them for doing it so far. And they've been a fun team to watch. They were an interesting team to watch last year for just the sake of, they had a lot of young players that were all of a sudden contributing, and they were really kind of integrating the academy kids in through the defense and within the midfield. And now they're really starting to step up, and you've got Marco Fabian there, that makes it interesting, and a dynamic group of forwards, some good depth signings as well. So, props on Ernst Tanner for, kind of putting the whole project together, and props to Curtin and the players for getting it executed and integrated so quickly to put them in this position so early in the season.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, Dan. I think that in hindsight, this doesn't surprise me for a couple of reasons. I think, you know, Philly got off to a little bit of a slow start. But if you look at the numbers, their X goal difference, so the expected goals that they were expected to score versus the number of goals that they actually scored, that number was the largest of any of the teams in MLS, which effectively meant that they were unlucky or poor at finishing, or just their strikers weren't taking advantage of the chances that they actually had. And this run is really, really simple in that now their forwards are taking it are taking advantage of their opportunities. And that's whether it's been Marco Fabian or the young guy, I think Johan Aronson, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And then certainly the Fapapicos and the David Akams of the world as well. So in that, I think it's, you know, it's really simple that you saw them creating a whole bunch of chances and just getting a little bit unlucky and ultimately losing games where you were disappointed, where if you were a Union fan, you were disappointed in the result, but not the performance. It was just, you know, can somebody finish one of their chances and can they get a bounce go their way? And their forwards have found their way to be effective. And maybe this was all just, you know, David Akam having that absolute explosion against the Columbus Crew when they had all their guys called up to international duty, and now he's playing relaxed and the team's much more confident. Maybe that's what's going on there. So in that, I'm not surprised at where they're at, especially given where the rest of the Eastern Conference is just, you know, absolute garbage. Anybody has a good month and they're going to be the top up there. I look at the Union and I don't see any distinct weaknesses. Obviously, their defense is still a little bit young with, you know, Austin Trusty, the homegrown, and then Jack Elliott, you know, I thought was fantastic the other night against FC Cincinnati, a 2-0 win for the Union off the top of my head. So, you know, they've been good. Their midfield obviously is a very workmanlike group, you know, with Harris Mnunin and company, and then their forwards have gotten it done. Where my concern for the long run the Philadelphia Union is right now is they don't have an individual talisman who can single-handedly take over games. You know, they don't have a David Villa who in NYCFC is just not feeling it. He can single-handedly say, get me the ball two times, guys, and I'm going to take over the game. You know, that they don't have a Jozy Altidore or Pozuelo, for example. You know, maybe last year Joseph Martinez, maybe not this year Joseph Martinez and Pity Martinez. They don't have one of those guys who, when push comes to shove, in, you know, an absolute, just a, you know, a crazy, grinded out, ugly playoff game or a road game, you know, at the end of you know, 3 games in 8 days, where they just need to try and get a result on the road against a really, really good team. They don't have one of those players. There's no Wayne Rooney on this team. They don't have somebody like that either in attack or defense, you know, throwing the Michael Parkhursts and the Chad Marshalls of the world. They don't have one of those. But in terms of, like, if I'm an opponent for taking on the Philadelphia Union, I'm thinking I'm going to go at this distinct weakness and I'm going to turn that leak into a complete break in the dam. They don't have an obvious weakness. There's clearly things that Atlanta's doing not well right now that if you're a good team and a well-coached team with good ideas, you can find a way to take advantage of that. I could say the same thing about NYCFC. I could certainly say the same thing about what the New York Red Bulls have been doing recently. And then, of course, you know, the FC Cincinnati's and the New England Revolutions and the other doormats of the league. But, like, there's no one distinct Achilles heel that I look at in the Union right now that I think I can take advantage of. And in that, I think by them being just good and solid everywhere else, they're able to get results against other teams despite not having, you know, that $4 million DP, you know, who's going to single-handedly take over games. I still have some concerns. I don't think they're going to finish top of the Eastern Conference this year. I'd want to sit down and really think about it to say, hey, could they finish top three or top four? But I think there was a lot of reservations about where this team was in terms of roster building, in terms of style of play going into the season, that kind of had me thinking they're a bubble team probably on the outside looking in. And now I think very likely they'll be a playoff team, maybe playing exclusively on the road when it's all said and done come October. Let's move on, Dan. We got some news earlier today regarding the MLS All-Star Game opponent for the MLS All-Stars that'll be taking place at Audi Field this year, question mark?
No, it's at, well,
Orlando?
It's at Orlando.
Orlando City Stadium. Yes. And they'll be taking on Atletico Madrid, one of the main powers of the Spanish La Liga. And I think this is really interesting, Dan, because I immediately saw this and thought this is totally a play to try and get some general manager from MLS to smooth up Anton Griezmann to try and get him to MLS. Dan, what do you think about, you know, we've seen the other two main powers in La Liga play in the MLS All-Star game. You know, are we excited about the other Madrid team coming in, and what do we think about them playing in Orlando?
I mean, I'm fine with it, to be honest. I like Atletico Madrid. I like what they've done in terms of play in Europe. They're a little bit pragmatic at times, but man, they are a very, very good team. A lot of dynamic players. It'll be cool to, I won't say it'll be cool to see them play because I'm not going out there. I wish I could, but it is going to be just a cool event. It's going to be a much smaller stadium than they've done the past two, where they had, obviously you had Audi Field with Juventus, and or not, Mercedes-Benz Stadium with Juventus, and then you also had it at the Soldier Field against Real Madrid. Have that kind of setup, so that will be exciting to see this coming year. Just because it's a very different team than a Real Madrid and a Barcelona and Bayern Munich and some of the others that they've had come to the States for, some of the really big ones that they've had come to the States for the All-Star game. So I'm looking forward to it. It'll be a good matchup. I think it'll be more like the Roma matchup that we saw than anything else. Just a very, you know, they almost, I mean, Simeone is Argentinian, but he's got a little bit of an Italian streak in him. Granted, I'm sure that comes from his many years playing in Lazio, but so that's why I kind of they play like an Italian team at times. So they were, you know, I'll call them an Italian team. They play Italian soccer pretty much more than they do the Spanish style that you would see maybe in Barcelona or in Madrid. So, or Real Madrid, but pragmatic, going to be interesting, going to be tough for MLS team on not a whole lot of experience together to break down. But it'll be a good matchup and a good festivity in Orlando. I think it'll be one. I like them in the smaller settings like this. I think it's more intimate and it's a better fan experience because you get to see these guys in such a close, intimate setting. So it'll be cool. I hope it goes well for, not just, I hope MLS wins, but I hope overall it's an event that MLS and the league can be proud of as well.
I'm really, really excited, if nothing else, for the banter in this game. You know, I remember Pep Guardiola when he was here for the All-Star game at Portland, and him and Caleb Porter getting into it. And of course, you know, like, Caleb Porter is not afraid to, you know, throw the verbal jabs there, and Pep Guardiola just wasn't having it with the way that game was played at Providence Park. So you add in Diego Simeone, who is a character and a little bit crazy, and then you add probably, other than Sergio Ramos, probably the most CONCACAF-y player in all of La Liga in Diego Costa. Like, I really hope that Costa starts or plays, you know, at least 45 minutes in this game, and Antoine Griezmann as well, just because, you know, you get one good bantery all-star out there, and like, it's gonna be really, I don't know if it's gonna be good soccer, I don't know if it's gonna be competitive in terms of the two teams taking it seriously, but it's going to be good television in like a crappy, crazy team chaos like WWE production is. So I'm really, really excited for that. If I am David Beckham or any of his front office members who might exist by the time the All-Star game comes out, I would absolutely be hitting this up as much as possible to try and recruit future players. So, you know, I think it's going to be really interesting to see if there's any, you know, backroom dealings or conversations, especially with how really publicly open Antoine Griezmann has been about his next move, at least if he ends up doesn't retire with Atleti, wanting to come to MLS. I think he'd be an absolute fantastic genius and meister on the ball in MLS, and I legitimately think that there's at least excuse me, listeners, still overcoming a cold. I think there's 21 teams right now who could say that, you know, at least 21 teams right now who would take him on a DP contract at like $4 million a year and immediately would be one of the most impactful players on their team. So I'm really excited to see what that is. Let's move on, Dan, to maybe the one last negative thing that we have to talk about for the rest of the show, and that is Zlatan being an absolute crazy man, both in the literal and the figurative sense, with some of his, I would say, borderlining on violent conduct, certainly very fight clubby, you know, physical rough and tumble football with several RSL defenders on the Sunday. Ultimately, Zlatan gets the goal that is the game winner, but a lot of banter after that. He goes into the RSL locker room to apologize to a couple of players. That doesn't go well in a very WWE behind the scenes sort of way. And then you've had comments now from both of them with LA Galaxy players who've defended their captain and their teammate, and then RSL players effectively saying, like, I'm not accepting your apology. Like, you were ultimately saying that you were going to be violent against me, and then you got a yellow card for it. Like, what is this about? I can understand, Dan, on a philosophical level, that Zlatan was frustrated with the way that the game was going, and he didn't feel that he was getting the ball, and he needed to do something to both get more involved in the game and get himself riled up. You know, I would think, like, a player almost like hitting themselves in the head, trying to psych themselves up, getting the adrenaline going, or, you know, getting, you know, really verbal in a positive pump up way with teammates, and that being a way to, you know, come alive, as Zlatan said, or try and get themselves in the game, get their head in the game, find the energy. But Zlatan did it in a way that was inherently negative and detrimental, and, you know, I would say certainly endangering the opponent is maybe a little bit strong. I would say putting the opponent at risk, or doing so in a way that wasn't healthy for the whole of the way that the game was played. And ultimately, I think fairly took a yellow card in the process for it. Dan, your thoughts on the approach that Zlatan had to that, and ultimately the way that he carried it out, and then the aftermath in terms of how the two parties involved have tried to articulate their feelings about what went down at Dignity Health Sports Park on Sunday night.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of a black mark for the league. I mean, I understand why Nada Manoha's like, nah, dude, I'm not going to accept an apology. That's bullcrap. There's a lot of ways for players to psych themselves up and try and play kind of a mental and even have some mental gamesmanship conversations. But there's also a point, you know, the whole don't cross the line campaign. I mean, that kind of a speech is in the same thing. A lot of that came from, you know, the Alan Gordon situation and trying to make sure players weren't crossing the line in terms of racist or homophobic, sexist, any kind of comments like that that are not okay and derogatory, but I mean, threatening violence and stuff like that
that could be perceived as a felony depending on the lore you have on your side.
That's in the same conversation. I mean we're talking the same boat here. At least somewhat in the same boat, but it falls under that don't cross the line thing. And I'm kind of disappointed the league didn't kind of show some kind of show of force, but I think that's the problem here is you see Nani gets away with this ridiculous temper tantrum against the Rapids down there. You've seen Zlatan get away with elbows and stuff to players before. You've seen Joseph Martinez. You've seen, was it Rui Diaz or Rodero or somebody like that last year? There was a Sounders player, one of their big players, DPs last year, got into the same kind of a thing last year and didn't receive any retribution for it. So if the league's going to send that message, then it can't be suspending guys, it can't be suspending guys for things like that that aren't that. To be honest, I was hoping that the Marco Fabian extra gain that he got for stomping down on Johnny Russell's chest in air pretty obviously intentionally as well, they gave him the extra game suspension, and I think that's a fair thing. He's a designated player, and he is a high profile player that is in this league, and they should be held to I wouldn't even say they should be held to a higher standard, but they should be held to the same standard as Daniel Lovitz and Jack Price. You know what I'm saying? Like, they should not be able to get away with extra crap. I'm not necessarily advocating they should have suspended him, but there should have been a fine. There should have been something from the league at this point. But, this is still part of the MLS that we live in, and it caters to the big players and the big names and the names that make them the and that's how it's going to go for now until they decide that they're not going to do that. So sooner or later, and another thing, too, that the disciplinary committee cannot do much if it is not in the referee's match report. That is another thing to understand and to kind of to keep in mind about all of this. They can't do much if it's not in the referee's match report. There's not a lot that they can do about it. And the referee's match report, that comes up from officials via like the replay officials and things that they saw. That comes from player, the officials on the field and the conversations that they heard. It comes from the fourth official about what was going on at the touchline. It comes from their multi other cameras that Pro has within stadiums to catch high angles and stuff like that, that the TV cameras wouldn't catch overall action. It's like a high angle view of the field and stuff like that, that they keep up high along with the match official and, or the, I guess the match oversight for Pro for all of these games. So they have all that stuff and they can use any of that to submit to the disciplinary committee, for action, and that all goes into the official game report. So if something like that doesn't come into the official game report, then they can't do something about that. So as much as we've heard about it in the media, I think it is on to a point too where players like Nate Manoha should definitely maybe have said something to the referee and be like, look, this is what he's saying. This is the kind of language. And that is something that the referee has to put in the report. And then maybe you get some action out of it, because right now it's a bunch of hearsay, even though both kind of sides have confirmed it. The disciplinary committee really can't do much about it, even if that is the case, which I don't think is necessarily right, but that's just part of the process is what I'm trying to say here. So, it's disappointing. Zlatan has always been kind of a fiery, trash talky kind of guy, but, goodness sakes, Martin Jones again, but
yeah, Nathan MacKinnon again. Sorry, listeners, we're both actively watching the Sharks San Jose game. Spoiler alert for those of you who haven't checked the score line, but in any case, continue, Dan.
Yeah, it's one of those. It's just those one of those things, and that Zlatan has long been a trash talker, someone who likes to psych himself up, likes to try and play the mind games with an opponent. But at the same time, you can't cross the line. You can't cross the line physically. You cannot cross the line verbally as well. And I just like to see guys like him, guys like Nani, guys like others held to a higher standard within this league.
No, I retweet favorite, Dan. I'm not defending Zlatan or going to be an apologist or a homer here on any of this. I would say at the very least what Zlatan did and how he carried himself was chicken-esque, fill in the word, listeners. And it was behavior not befitting of one of the star players in MLS, you know, a guy who, you know, wants to be the poster boy for the league, and certainly not befitting for the highest paid player, main DP on one of the, you know, flagship franchises of the league, let alone someone who's a captain and tries to be a good example for the kids. You know, there's been a number of really good examples of Zlatan doing community work or engaging with, young kids and doing so in a positive way. And, you know, if I'm a parent taking my kid to an LA Galaxy game, how Zlatan carried himself on Sunday, that's not someone I want to be the hero on the poster, you know, someone who my kid as a soccer player is trying to carry themselves out. So it wasn't befitting. I absolutely would have been fine with a fine towards Zlatan, especially given, you know, what Chris Roldan was fined for in his actions this past week. And, you know, I agree with you that there's a loophole in it not being in the match report where, you know, everything that Zlatan was doing was probably near the middle of the pitch, you know, with, you know, nobody else within 5 yards. So unless the official's right there, he's not hearing anything. But, you know, that's, you know, it was legitimately disappointing. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, both sides confirming it. When Zlatan was asked about it, he kind of did a really political sidestep and made a big deal out of, well, I was just trying to get myself in the game. But he didn't deny it. So if the comments from the RSL players are true, then, like, you know, what's the... It's hard, like, you can't say that, oh, what's, like, it, there was intent for violent conduct in there, even if Zlatan didn't carry himself out. So, you know, Zlatan, not that you're listening to this, but, you know, if you legitimately find yourself wanting to get alive in the game, I completely understand that. I understand wanting to change what you're doing in the game from a conduct standpoint or how you're playing tactically to try to do that, but there are healthier and less dangerous ways of going about it than, you know, some of the chicken-esque stuff that you said and some of the chicken-esque stuff that you acted on in the aftermath of that. All right, Dan, let's move on. It is time for us to get to rapid fire. And we will start with a former player in MLS trying to get back in MLS. That is Omar Gonzalez, a longtime center back for the LA Galaxy, moved on to Pachuca, won a couple of trophies there. Now kind of struggling on a very struggling Atlas team, and is looking to come back to the league through allocation. There are reports via Paul Tenorio over at The Athletic, that he is in conversations with Toronto FC, who have the number one allocation slot as a U.S. international, for Omar Gonzalez to come back to the league. It would have to be through allocation. Last he was in the league, Dan, his last full season, he was the third DP on the LA Galaxy, and then targeted allocation money came into existence. The Galaxy signed Giovanni Dos Santos, and then Omar became a TAM player. I don't think he'll be a TAM player at this point. 30 years old, definitely over the hill in terms of his defensive marking. Still good in possession and certainly can put on a nice header as well on both sides of the ball. Defending corners or certainly attacking set pieces as well. I think there's a number of teams who would like his services and have him be a pretty high budget or maybe even a max budget player. I'm sure there's at least one team that would be willing to throw targeted allocation money at him. As someone who watched him in his final years with the LA Galaxy and likes to keep up with Liga MX, I personally, if I was a general manager, would not offer him a TAM contract, or at least not for very long, or I'd put in some other incentives or mechanisms such that he wouldn't be a TAM player in future years on the contract. I understand where Toronto FC would have interest, but I'm not sure that it makes sense immediately for me unless the money's really at an area where they want and Omar's okay with that. And that's for a couple of reasons. I think they're okay as far as the center back position is concerned. They also don't have a whole lot of youth at the center back position. So adding another veteran guy I think could help, but it's also another guy who could get hurt. Lauren Simon and Drew Moore have had pretty bad track records the last couple of years in terms of staying healthy. And with the way that Chris Mavinga plays, even though he's a healthier player than both of those, he's more prone to injuries with his style of play. Obviously, the Reds have some defensive issues to work around, but I don't know that making Omar Gonzalez a max budget player is the answer. And I also think that there's other teams that would be more desperate for Omar Gonzalez's services such that they could trade the number one allocation slot as an asset in order to get something else that would be potentially useful to them. I think they need some wing help in the midfield, maybe another support piece in some aspect of the attack to help out Pozuelo, and Josie Altidore. If you told me right now that Toronto was already looking at some of those options or is planning to have that be be their main target in the summer, I'm okay with that. And, you know, if you told me right now that Omar Gonzalez was going to be on, you know, say a 1-year deal with a team option, is going to be making like $200,000 or something like that, I'd be okay with this move. But if you told me right now that Toronto FC are making this their primary target and they're looking to get this deal done and have Omar Gonzalez on, say, you know, this year's contract plus another two and have it be a targeted allocation money, I think there are other ways that Toronto could handle that. And I think there's other teams that would definitely be bidding for Gonzalez's service coming back to MLS. Let's move on, Dan, to other teams that are dealing with a lot of other issues. And that is Sporting Kansas City, who have a pretty solid starting 11. They're just sitting on the medical bench in the locker room at Children's Mercy Park. Dan, what's going on with Peter Vermes' team, and what the heck is he going to do from a lineup standpoint on Sunday?
So I'm not sure what he's going to do from a lineup standpoint on Sunday. It's going to be really interesting to see how it comes out. I do think some of the key, we'll say this, the front three is still healthy. Outside of Jersey, 6 weeks with the broken wrist. You saw the nasty fall last weekend against but Daniel Shalvey will step in, who was the team's leading goal scorer last year. They still have Johnny Russell and Christian Namath, who has been scoring goals left and right for them to start the season. So they have that. They still have Felipe Gutierrez. They will still have Graham Zusi in that lineup and Tim Melia. So there's still going to be a few familiar faces where it gets Felipe Gutierrez. As Gianluca Busio, who has been the first choice, is out with the U17 national team. He got one goal today in their comeback win against Canada. They were down 2-0. He scored the first in the second half to start their comeback. That they eventually won that match 3-2. They also have forward Tyler Freeman, who is with the U17. So here it is. Sporting Kansas City have 9 players currently on their injury list, including Gerso. I think last week they started with 7. They're up to 9 now, as Andrew Fontas has gone back on, as well as he was doing drills today though, so he didn't look too bad. There's a chance he'll be at least in the 18. I won't say 18. So there's 28 men on their roster. They have 9 injured. They have 9 injured in some way, shape, or form, potentially, that could be even out. And then they have 2 away. So that leaves them with 17 total players potentially healthy. Or at least 17 players that are healthy. And that includes their entire 28-man roster, which includes all 3 goalkeepers and any player that they have on loan to Swope Park Rangers that has not played a minute for the first team yet. So, there's a lot of interesting things that are going to be going on this week. We will see how they line up against, Atlanta United. It's going to be interesting. It'll be interesting to see how they approach the game. Sporting Kansas City are kind of swimming, walking wounded, but I think it's one. I will say that, you know, they've been letting in a lot of goals, yes, but they still, you know, their one loss in the last few weeks has been San Jose within the league. Outside of that San Jose loss, they hadn't lost since they played LAFC in the opening week. So through all these injuries, through everything that's been kind of going on for them, they've still been able to relatively get results. They got the point last week in that crazy 4-4 match. I think, and they are at the very bottom of their depth chart at this point. I think it's kind of a testament to their depth that they actually have, because in, you know, 2017, this team would be killed off. At this point, they probably wouldn't have won a game in the last 3 or 4, or even picked up a point in the last 3 or 4 matches. So, for them to still be getting results and still be kind of riding it out is pretty impressive. Says a lot about their depth, especially since they are at the very bottom of it right now. I do have a feeling it'll look the back line, will be familiar faces, and the front three should be familiar faces. Where it gets interesting is that midfield. So stay tuned to see what happens, and how many goalkeepers
order. Good stuff, Dan. Let's move on back to the Eastern Conference. We talked about the Philadelphia Union getting a big win over the FC Cincinnati, and we'll talk about some of the comments from Alan Koch, the head coach over at FCC, with some He had some comments after the game regarding some of the offensive woes that they've had recently. Obviously, there have been off-the-field issues with Fernando Adi, and the team struggled a little bit. They also haven't really had a good schedule during the last couple of games, and let's face it, they're a budget expansion team. Budget expansion teams usually have struggles throughout the season, their expansion season, and then ultimately don't make the playoffs. Alan Koch had some comments after the game that have kind of been thrown into the same category as what Alan Hudson said and ultimately his final press availability as the head coach of the Rapids against Atlanta, calling it a bottom group of players, saying that we're just not very good and we're not in a position to succeed. Alan Koch's comments were kind of thrown in that, and I personally disagree with that characterization. Here's the quote. based on what he said after the game against Philadelphia. He said, let's call it what it is. Right now, we can't buy ourselves a goal. We came here tonight. We created chances. We didn't take them. We did the exact same thing in the second half against New York in the last game. But we've got to keep persevering. I think we're on the cusp. You can see how the guys came together tonight and applied themselves. Their work rate was first class. They did everything we asked them to do. We came to Philly, who are first in the Eastern Conference. We came to a tough place to play and we created chances. I was watching this game on MLS Live on ESPN Plus, Dan, and it ended up being the FC Cincinnati feed that I got. And Koch was interviewed at halftime when it was still 0-0, I believe, and he said, you know, we've created a couple chances, we need to sharpen things up, but we're doing okay. Ultimately, you know, the better team and the better performance for me ultimately prevailed. I don't see Alan Koch at all at throwing his team under the bus at this point. They created chances, and I agree with him. They just weren't really, really that sharp. And look, that happens to every single team in MLS over the course of a 3-4 game period in an entire season. So if anything, I would say he's complimentary in the terms of the performance was there, just the results weren't. And like, let's face it, they've had a really, really tough schedule. So I don't see this at him saying that things are bad. I look at it him saying almost like what I talked about with the Philadelphia Union, where they were creating chances, they had good performances, the ball just wasn't going in the net. And okay, Darren Maddox is a wildly inconsistent forward, and, you know, not Weston McKennie, who am I thinking of? Kenny Safe hasn't been starting for the team, and Kukure Mane is inconsistent. As we talked about, Fernando Adi is obviously dealing with some other stuff off the field. So, okay, like, their forwards are having issues right now, but everything else has been okay, given where this team is from a spending standpoint and from a talent standpoint. Just the ball hasn't gone in, and eventually, though, you know, somebody's gonna get hot or they're gonna find a way to convert their chances if they keep going about this route. I don't see this at him saying in anywhere in connotation or tone saying anything close to what Anthony Hudson said. If anything, if I'm an FC Cincinnati player, I'm encouraged. He's saying that, okay, the performance is there, we just have to keep working on it, and the results will ultimately go, let's go back and apply ourselves, and then, you know, get to the devil in the details. So I'm not hanging my had if I'm an FC Cincinnati player anywhere on the field, back to front, you know, other than maybe Fernando Adi, who I think has to be a better professional off the field, you know, in the same way that, you know, the Rapids are probably, you know, had been reeling the last couple of days until, you know, Porrick Smith came in, gave everybody a pat on the back, you know, after firing Anthony Hudson. Let's move on, Dan, and this will be some of the last comments. Speaking of other things that coaches are saying, you've got some banter about the Quakes, and I'm really, really excited to hear what it is.
Yeah, so my good friend and our former colleague here at Last Word, well, I guess still colleague, but he just doesn't write for us anymore, but Joel Soria of Last Word the Quakes Epicenter. Goodness, he used to be. Goodness, I'm all over the place. All right, Joel Soria of Quakes Epicenter. Reported earlier this week, he had a conversation he had with Matias Almeida, that Matias Almeida told him that an assistant coach from one of the teams that they have recently played, told a player of theirs that what the San Jose Earthquakes were doing, quote, wasn't soccer. Which I find very interesting. San Jose Earthquakes, if you don't know, have been on a great run of form recently, picking up a win against Portland. They lost to Houston, but then beat Sporting Kansas City by a score of 4-1. They ended up beating, or they tied Seattle 2-2 in Seattle, and then went and played a 0-0 draw against FC Dallas. Played kind of pragmatic for the first about 60 minutes, and then after playing you know, three games in 7 days. They went out for the final 30 minutes and just rammed it down FC Dallas's throat and tried to get a winner at the end, which completely caught FC Dallas by surprise. If you look at the game flow of it, it's insane kind of to think about how, where they were at for their last 30 minutes, in their third game in 7 days. But, what they've been doing, they've been getting points, they've been getting results, they've done it on the road in tough environments, like a hot Dallas afternoon, like a Seattle, midweek Seattle night, and doing it against good teams like Sporting Kansas City. So, impressive run of form for the Earthquakes. But if you've been watching them and what they've been doing, I think it's very, very hard to call what they've been doing not soccer. They've been incredibly impressive, pragmatic at times, yes. But they've been impressive in the goals that they have scored, their teamwork, and their fluid transition play, which has been a staple, of what Almeida likes to do. They look like a Liga MX team, playing in MLS. They just maybe don't have the quality that a lot of these Liga MX teams would have. But if you watch the way that they play and the way that they try to play, my goodness, they look like a Monterrey, just not with all the talent. They kind of play the same way. That's the same. It's a very Liga MX style. And they've been doing a great job of it. It's a bit of a Quakes resurgence. I'm not going to go into full Quakes rant mode tonight, but positive things happening in the South Bay. And for an assistant coach of whoever it was, of one of their more recent games, to say that what they were doing wasn't soccer is just absolutely ridiculous.
Well said, Dan. All right, it is time for us to move on to pick'ems. We'll start with the Saturday afternoon games. We'll start on ESPN at 2 p.m. Eastern. New York Red Bulls hosting the LA Galaxy. Dan, who you got and why?
So I'm going to go with a 1-1 draw. And the Red Bulls do not allow a lot of goals. Their back line has been relatively strong. Luis Robles has been playing well. They don't have Kaku as their creator. He is still out from that suspension. This will be, I believe, the second of the three extra games that he got. This is his last week of his suspension. But Red Bulls will be without him, but they should have most of their first choice guys. Like I said, 1-1 draw seems fit here. The Galaxy, as good as they've been in their ability to get points and stuff, the results are so centered around whether or not Zlatan can score a goal or two. At least their wins have been centered around whether or not Zlatan can score a goal. New York's a good defensive team, and at home, I'm just gonna say they keep them in check for a little bit. I'll go 1-1, as I said earlier.
I'll agree with you, Dan. I think both defenses have gradually improved. Obviously, the Red Bulls, had a little bit of issues earlier on in the season. The defense, obviously, the big weakness for the LA Galaxy, but things are starting to come together in terms of the new players coming in terms of what the personnel decisions have been at right back as well. And I think David Bingham's doing well with the shots that he's had to face. I still think the attacking quality is there for both teams, and they'll both be able to find goals, but ultimately, it'll be a share of the spoils. I'll take 1-1. Let's move on to the Texas Derby, the battle for El Capitan. This will take place at Houston. Houston Dynamo hosting FC Dallas at BBVA Compass Stadium. This will be at 4 p.m. Eastern on Univision. Dan, who you got and why, and how lit is the Spanish language commentary going to be for this match?
This one's going to be a fun one. I'm going to go with Houston, though. They're fully healthy, and I think they're one of the better teams in the Western Conference when at full strength. And this Dallas team will be without Paxton Pomykal, who has been incredibly integral to their attacking to their attack, their transition, and into creating chances for their front three. He's been one of the best at creating key passes, or if you look at, I believe, American Soccer Analysis, or somebody who works with them, kind of came out with a chart today that showed who created the most passes that led to key passes. I believe Paxton Pomykal is up there, and as well as key passes himself, which is a pass that either leads to a shot, a goal, or a key pass is a pass that leads to a shot, goal, or an assist. So it's kind of the hockey assist, basically. Those key passes from Pomykal, not coming from the midfield. They don't really have another type that can replace him in the midfield. So, I think Dallas on the road, Houston full strength. I expect Houston to get the result here. I will say 3-1 to the Houston Dynamo, just because I think that front three will be raring and chomping at the bit to go.
I'll take 2-1 in this game. I think Lucha Gonzalez is going to have FC Dallas coming in being very pragmatic, trying to defend things really well. They're definitely not going to have the same offensive bite without Paxton Pomacol in this one. That said, I think, you know, it'll almost, they'll be playing to their strength in terms of letting Houston have the ball, and then they'll be prone to counterattacks where I think FC Dallas will ultimately get a goal. But I mean, this Houston Dynamo team is roaring. They've got a lot of attacking quality, and I think they're going to find a way to break things down. There's only so much that Rito Ziegler and Matt Hedges are going to be able to do. I'll take Albert Elise, and we'll say Mario Minotas on the goals, and on the other side, maybe Barrios on a counterattack for FC Dallas, but it'll be 2-1 to Houston. And I believe they'll be, at least for now, still hanging on to El Capitan. Let's move on to the Ozzy Alonso Derby. Dan, Minnesota United back at Allianz Field hosting Seattle Sounders, 8 p.m. Eastern. This will be on ESPN+. Dan, who you got? And I guess more importantly, let's do an over-under on how many fouls do you think Ozzy Alonso is going to commit in this game?
It'll be interesting to see how many he does. I'm going to go with a 2-2 scoreline here. Minnesota's been able to get goals. They've looked good going forward. DC United is kind of a tough nut to crack defensively at times, and they'd shown really good throughout the week. When then Minnesota goes and does get that goal at the end, they get two clean sheets last week. Seattle's a bit more potent offense, I think, than what they played at all last week, at least in terms of just currently on form and cohesive. But they are going with a little bit injuries. I they're a little bit snake bitten at the moment. I'm going to go, actually going to change it up. I'll say Minnesota wins it 2-1. But I think it'll be one of the most entertaining games of the day.
I'll take 2-2 in this one. I think Ozzy Alonso is definitely going to be fired up to play his former club. I think the Ozzy Alonso hasn't played with any other club other than Minnesota and Seattle and MLS, if I remember correctly. Correct me if I'm wrong there, Dan.
No, you're correct.
Okay, cool. I think he's going to be fired up for this game. At the same time, you know, Seattle's kind of had a weird stretch there, you know, with the two crazy games against LAFC, where they certainly didn't look their best, and then, you know, they had that crazy midweek game, you know, against San Jose, which I agree with you, Dan, that San Jose does play actual soccer right now. And then, you know, obviously they had the incident, but then, you know, Christian Roldan is available. I think this is going to be all about, you know, the grudge match in the midfield. I like both offenses against the opposing defenses, so I'll take a 2-2 draw in this one. And let's move on to the lone Sunday game. As you talked about earlier, Dan, Sporting Kansas City, or possibly a Sporting Swope Park, taking on Atlanta United. This will be at 9 p.m. Eastern. Oof, that's a late one for you on FS1. Dan, who you got and why?
Man, Atlanta has just, this is so hard because Atlanta have looked good at times. I think Sporting Kansas City have struggled at times recently. But both teams have really kind of struggled, period. I do like the front three of what Sporting Kansas City has. I like, their ability to score goals and get in, kind of behind and create some chances. If Sporting Kansas City are able to, have some of the possession and kind of dominate their possession good, the biggest thing is if they can eliminate any kind of long ball over the top to Joseph Martinez or, one of their, quick little wingers there. I think that is going to be the big question that has been what has plagued them with their high line all season long. And their current defensive issues stem from not being able to handle simple balls over the top and in behind. So, we will see what happens. It's so hard with the way both teams are at right now, in terms of form for Atlanta and health for Sporting Kansas City. I guess I'll say 1-1. Most of their games have been pretty tight the last couple of years, and I believe Sporting did get a 1-1 draw the last time Atlanta was here. It's going to be a late game for Atlanta mentally, so it'll be interesting to see how this one goes. Like I said, I'll go 1-1 in this one. It's hard to see a winner between two teams that are just kind of struggling right now.
I have a hard time. This is probably, of the pick-ems that we have, Dan, this is probably the one that I have the least confidence in. You know, Atlanta's probably feeling at least slightly better about themselves getting their first win, albeit against the Rapids, and, you know, they fired their coach midweek, but at the same time, like, the result's the result. And at the same time, like you said, I feel a lot better making this prediction after we get the lineup, just because I have no idea what Sporting Kansas City is going to look like. So for those reasons, I'm going to pick a 1-1 draw, just because that's kind of, you know, that's in the middle of the crazy wide error bars that I see in this game. You know, if I could see Peter Vermees coming out and being extremely pragmatic and just say, hey, let's try and get a result and make it not pretty. And I could see the ugliest, most boring 0-0 draw ever out of that game. I could see Atlanta blowing them out. At the same time, you know, I don't think Atlanta's past the point where Frank DeBoer isn't doing stuff to unknowingly undermine everything that Atlanta aspired to be last year. So I could see circumstances, I could see where Peter Vermees just isn't in a position to be successful on Sunday. Not his fault, injuries happen. And I could also see where Frank DeBoer single-handedly could cause Sporting Kansas City to win this game, and I could see anything in between. So for those reasons, I'm going to take the in-between and just say a 1-1 draw. The fullest, like, if the lineups are wildly crazier than anything you're expecting, Dan, I will fully throw out this and say that I have no idea what's going to happen in this match. That's all that we have tonight, Dan. Let's start with last words. Where can people find you on Twitter, and do you have any last words?
So you can find me on Twitter at @SperryDanielline. Last words, none since I got to give my little San Jose Earthquakes talk earlier, and I was happy I kept it short. So enjoyed sports equinox and this craziness that's going to ensue over the next 3 or 4 months. Also, I will say this as a parting thanks to our sponsor, Golden Gold Press, the best choice for you to get custom shirts, hats, mugs, and other items for just yourself or your organization. Check out their amazing products at a fraction of the price of other places at goldengoldpress.com.
Well said, Dan. I don't have crazy last words other than me saying, you know, reiterating I had an absolute blast going to London. You know, got to do the stadium tour at Stamford Bridge, home of Chelsea FC, and then going up to the Emirates on my Fulham match day to check out, you know, where Arsenal play their games. Two fantastic stadiums, absolutely enjoyed it. And then great to see Fulham get a win. You know, fantastic strike by Ryan Bobble there to probably send Cardiff City down. So, you know, Craven Cottage was great. You know, Dan, as a baseball fan, you'll appreciate it. Probably, I think, the closest thing in English football to a, you know, maybe the jewel box stadiums that you have, certainly a Fenway Park, maybe including certain aspects of Wrigley Field. I know Wrigley's undergone some alterations that have modernized it, but, you know, go back 10 years and sit in the bleachers, and there were a lot of aspects of experiencing that at Wrigley Field that I think were similar to what I had at the Hammersmith End this past Saturday. So really enjoyed it, and looking forward to seeing another small club aspiring to do better things on Friday as the Colorado Rapids begin the Connor Casey era against the Vancouver Whitecaps. With that, listeners, thank you to our sponsor, Roughneck Scarves, the official scarf supplier for MLS, USL, and US Soccer. Get your custom scarves for your group or your team at roughneckscarves.com. Listeners, you can follow me on Twitter at @LWSMattPollard. Check us out at LastWordOnSoccer.com all season long, and at LastWordSC across all social media platforms. We'll see you next week.